Okay, folks, tonight is a speaker meeting, and it's my good pleasure to welcome Paula from North Hollywood. She's 4 years in the program, and she's been kind enough to share her story with us tonight. Paula, thank you.
Hi, my name is Paula. Thank you very much for asking me to come and share my experience, strength, depending on the moment, and hope for other people based on the 12 steps for Al-Anon, which is based on the 12 steps and principles which are outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. For those of you who are new, I share my experience only, and I'll do my best to keep out of my opinion, which is a little hard depending on my spiritual condition at the moment. I would like to thank all the people who took cakes. What a delight. There are some faces that I recognize here, and maybe we should have heard the last cake for about 45 minutes talk, although I don't think there would have been enough tissues in the room for the waterworks. Happy birthday to you all. My experience with Al-Anon is that's not really taken seriously, but as an Al-Anon, I take my life terribly seriously. And I'm going to tell you what you need to do so my life feels better about myself. If I can just control everything around me, my life would be magnificent. And I too would rule the world and be a movie star at the same time. You know, as you can tell, I have an accent. And it goes in and out depending on how passionate I get or what I talk about. I come from the south coast of England. And in England, alcoholism is a way of life. It is not a disease. You know, there's a famous footballer, an Irish footballer, Georgie Best, and I think he had to have a second liver transplant, and still maybe there wasn't a problem. You know, it just takes, you know, and when I first came into these rooms, I didn't really know I grew up in an alcoholic family until I started to sense what other people were talking about, because people still had a job, or they weren't on the streets, or they still had an apartment, or they were periodic, you know, around me. So, but why did I always carry the shame? You know, the shame that finds us. It doesn't matter what situation I'm in, I will find some shame about it. You know, I got propelled back into this program after I got hurt on the job. Absolutely worked myself into workaholism, because if I could just succeed in that money, property, and prestige, that would mean that I was okay. And the problem is that it's never enough, and it never feeds enough, or then I have the wrong employees, or then they're the right, then I'm, you know, they're younger than me and they shouldn't be, or I went to the wrong school, or I went to the right school, but I shouldn't have those student loans because I should have got a free ride, and that wasn't fair, and I mean, it just doesn't stop. The head doesn't stop, as people talked about earlier. I believe in my truth, my mother's drinking affected me profoundly, and my father's absence even more so. My first out-of-body experience, I call it, was on my 8th birthday when my father sat me down and said he was leaving and he couldn't stay for my birthday party. And I can still tell you right now, I can still see the room, I can still see me looking down, talking to him and asking him to stay. And the thing that people who, I'm gonna call the normies, is that shame doesn't go away. I can understand intellectually, I can grow up, I can think of all the great things that were saved and the perils and drama that did not happen that day as a result of that man taking that action and how difficult it must have been for him. However, the shame that I felt was that it was my fault. That was my fault. And therefore, my mother's drinking was my fault as well. It was all my fault, which actually is self-centeredness in extreme. The Al-Anonism I like to call dry drunkenness. It's just raw emotion. People talked about emotional sobriety here. And it's something that in a city like Los Angeles, people thrive on. And if I'm not in a spiritually fit condition, I will get sucked into that. Like, you can't believe. You just can't believe. So I always was a nervous child. How I describe my body, my spine, my nervous condition, is if you get a towel and you wring it out really tight and the water comes out, that tightness in the towel is like my nervous system in my body at all times. I'm basically ready to actually hit the button and for the bomb to go off. I've always got the keys in there and they're turned. That is where my nervous condition lives at. They're turned. So we need one more thing to mess me up, and that could be a hangnail or it could be bankruptcy. The same thing. In my body, and I can't get it out of my body. It's very tight in my body. It's very wound up. And so I decided that, I was so nervous as a child. I would have days off because I would have panic attacks. Luckily, you know, my mom had some relatedness because I can't go to school. I go, why? I feel sad. I just can't go to school. And she'd be like, all right. And yeah, thank God in some ways. But then what would happen was I would obsess about, do they miss me? Do they know that? Did they know that I was gone? And then am I going to catch up on the schoolwork? Because I had learning problems too, and I didn't really have that many friends because all I ever talked about was school. I didn't want to talk about home life or bring them at home because, you know, latchkey kids, you know, we were on the street where there was no other divorced family. You know, and I thought that was my fault, and the shame that we had to move to a smaller house. You know, and I was the one who was running the household. When things happened, I would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, go downstairs, make the porridge, and I'd make the packed lunch for me and my brother. That's what I would do. And then when the bullies went after them, they had something far more scary to deal with, and that was a big sister, who's likely to go psycho on you at any moment. You know, a psycho female as a teenager is a lot more scary than a boy wanting to punch you in the face. So I did my brother's fighting for him, and I looked after him. And that was a decision I made very young, because after my father left, I decided to rely on my granny, who I was really close to. And then my brother's following birthday, she passed away unexpectedly of meningitis on his birthday. And that's when I looked to God and I said, there are no human beings here for me, are there? You bring these people into my life and you take them away. So I realized in my head I am on my own. Now the fact of the matter is we come into this world with God and we stay with God and then we go back into the consciousness to be part of God. But I took that as I was deserted and it was because I'd done something wrong and I had shame. So I decided that moment with gritted teeth, is it a surprise that I have TMJ? that I'm not going to rely on any human being. I'm just not going to trust you. So I became a child that studied extra. I wasn't very good at school. You told me something was gray. I tell you, well, is it more black gray or more white gray? Which one is it? And the teachers would look at me like, does it matter? Does it really matter? But they didn't say that. It was just that look, you know, and they used to draw pictures of me on the blackboard, and I have brown curly hair, and they used to draw it and do these crazy curls, and underneath they'd write Paula. And I'd walk into that classroom and it was like, poof, that sinking feeling hit my stomach and my gut. That feeling of shame and there's something wrong with me. And that's the feeling that I have with everything. But then I didn't know it. I blamed school and I blamed them. You know, everyone was being blonde and straight hair there. You know, and as I get older, people are like, wow, that's naturally curly. You know, it's just, it's all perception. But I carried this shame with me, and I would get resentful at babysitters who were paid because I was running the household anyway in my head. That's what I thought, right? So why should you get paid? My mom should pay me. You know, I had secret bank accounts. I always had 3 jobs at one time, or no job, because I needed a break. Oh. You know, I am like the wind-up dog. And in fact, I don't just wind up the doll, I overwind her. So there's like, you know. And I would save secret bank accounts, because what if one time I had to visit my father and he just left us in the pub and he went off? Then I'd know that I had some money and I could plan my escape. I don't think that's really normal for most children to do. But I did it. You know, I was always planning what if, what if, what if. I got a locker at school one time because that's what you do. And I saw it on TV and I thought I'd best get a locker, and some of my friends were getting them. And I remember distinctly thinking, what do you put in a locker? And the thing was, I didn't want to put my books and stuff in the locker, because what if something went wrong and the headmaster was going to go through all your stuff and I was not going to have him blame me for something I didn't do? So he would get one up on me if he saw my homework and it wasn't perfect, or if I had the wrong textbooks in the locker. So I'm not going to put that in there. What I put in there was what I thought you were supposed to put in there. Like a lady shared previously, it took a birthday cake. I was what I thought you wanted me to be. So I put in that locker what I thought you were supposed to put in the locker. And then I carried this big bag every day to school. And I had all my school books, even for classes that weren't happening that day. All of my school books, and I would carry them around, and they'd be like, oh, that's the girl with the house, because I used to carry this big bag. And because I just didn't know if they were going to change the schedule on me. They just might change the academic year schedule last minute, and I was going to have the books, I was going to be ready. Because I don't want you putting something over me. You can't get one up on me, because I'm sick and tired of that, because I don't trust you guys, because you're always after something, aren't you? You adults have always got some angle on what you're saying. You tell do this and then you change your mind. You never come through with what you're going to say. I was always had promises, promises, promises as a child. Oh, we'd do this. And when it came to it, the promises were broken. You know, and I thought that there was something wrong with me because of that. That meant I wasn't good enough, you know. And so I decided to pursue a higher power greater than myself in a teenage year. And of course, suffering from this disease, I don't do anything half measured. I became a zealot, told my brother he was going to die unless he believed my certain beliefs. Tears in my eyes, it was terribly dramatic. Then I became a vegetarian. Well, there's anything wrong with being a vegetarian, but I sought it out for a solution to, for me not fitting in. And then I said, you know, God, I need some sign. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to be? You know? And quite frankly, there was no bolt of lightning. There was no big parade. There was no angel. So I believe God had ignored me yet again. I need a big drama because I'm a big drama. I can't see the signs because I'm blocked off with my own head and my own stuff, that I'm unable to be awake to the presence of the magnificence of God that is in each and every moment. I saw God, a higher power, as something outside myself. Right, and all I saw were these rules in the particular religions or groups I would belong to, and where I fell short, and how I would beat myself up because I did not meet the mark yet again. There was something wrong with me yet again. I would say a joke, nobody got it. Somebody else would say a joke, I didn't understand why it was funny. They would explain the joke, and I'd be like, yeah, I got that. And I'd be like, I just didn't find it funny. And I remember this picture of me envisioning myself alone. I always thought of myself as alone. A stranger in the room, I'm always alone. I would rather be alone, but then I would get terribly depressed. And then I would feel terribly anxious about being around other people. So I knew that the way to overcompensate for that is to be the life of the party. So that's what I did. I found things to help me become the life of the party so I didn't have to deal with myself. And so then I decided, in order to do that, you should pursue something where people would look at you all the time. So that's what I decided to do. I decided that England was my problem. And I'll move to America. Because in America, I will be considered smart, because the English school system was further ahead than the US system at the time. And Americans are stupid anyway, they like my accent. I'll do well in America. And the pound was very strong, so I can get twice as much for half the price because it's very cheap to live in America compared to England. So I moved to America. Except now, it was your fault. It was Americans' fault, not British people's fault. And, you know, oh, it's so much better in England. We have the BBC News. We know what's going on. And people drive on the other side of the road. They actually, you know, they actually signal when they go to turn. But I had a lot of trauma with it at the same time. Oh my God, the anxiety of going to the gas pump for the first time. At the time, you didn't prepay in the UK, you just filled it up. And you always had a pump that would reach either side. And then you just flip open the petrol cap. I'm in a car, it was a truck. I got this job driving a truck, somehow. And I didn't understand where the emergency brake was because I was used to a brake in the middle, so I don't know quite how to brake the thing. Then I didn't know that you pop the cap in the car for the thing, and I figured that out, and then it didn't reach over, and then I didn't know why I couldn't pump it, first of all, and it was just such a trauma. And that's my ism going with me everywhere I went. I mean, it's just going to the bloody petrol station and I'm having a breakdown, nervous breakdown over it. And I don't want to go there. Taking care of myself. I remember the first time I went to a nail shop in this country, and I left early. They did like these acrylic nails, and I couldn't sit and wait for them to finish it. I couldn't. Oh my God, what have I done? Everyone's gonna see. Now that's sort of the point of getting your nails done, is that people see. Couldn't deal with it. And then on the way home, and I'm driving in the car, you know, I start smudging it, and I'm like, oh, now they're gonna see the smudges. But I was smudging it because I was trying to get rid of it, but now there's a smudge that looks worse than what it was before. So people were like, oh, let's look at your, oh, what happened to your nails? And so now I have shame that I couldn't even do the nail job right, that I was having shame about doing in the first place. I just, you know, I mean, it sounds crazy, but I can actually wear open-toed shoes now. I had this thing that, any time, something's gonna land on me, okay? And I'm not gonna be able to get out. And if you have open-toed shoes and then your toes are hurt, it's really hard to run. And so, I really do sound like a mental case, don't I? I bring it up because my first Al-Anon sponsor that I really committed to, she said, do something so that you will be seen. And I went out and I bought some sandals. I mean, this is not a big deal. We're in Los Angeles. It's sunny, you know. And I bought these sandals, and then I was like, go to the nail shop. Oh, God, making amends, going back to the nail shop. Ooh, scene of the crime in my head, you know. And wear open-toed shoes. I mean, it was just so hot in the summer. My feet would be sweaty, blah, 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 you know. Gosh. And I just remember walking around thinking everybody was going to look at my feet, or that a car was going to roll over my foot because my toes were exposed, you know. But that was part of my, I don't want to be seen, but I desperately want your attention. I desperately want you to see me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to find myself, and I'm going to get into a relationship where you're not really going to quite see me, and then I'm going to try and make you see me. I'm going to spend all the time trying to make you love me and make you see me to fulfill my self-fulfilling prophecy in my inventory, basically, that I'm not seen and I'm not heard. See, I'm running on this inventory that I don't know I'm running on, the subconscious, all the time. I don't want to be seen, I don't want to be heard, but really I do want to be seen and I do want to be heard, but I can't take those actions to be seen and to be heard. I can't stand, I could never ask a question for what I needed. What I would do is I would suss you out and figure out what your soft spots were, and I'd try and manipulate you to the point that you would offer me what I wanted. Because then I didn't have to directly ask, and then I wouldn't be rejected, and then I wouldn't feel the shame. So here I am in this country, and I'm going to, first of all, adult child of alcoholic meetings. And you know, I sit around these meetings and I just take a good look at everyone. Oh God. Yeah, I'm just... Talk about shame. I'm feeling shame in a meeting full of people with shame. And I just can't believe I'm here. I moved to California, I've become a crackpot, living in 12-step rooms. Gosh, why didn't that religion thing work out? You know, I was just mortified, sitting in a room full of Californians talking about their flipping feelings. Oh, you Americans say anything. Oh, do shut up. I thought everyone had plastic surgery, like plastic surgery to smile on their face. Hi, how are you? Have a nice day. I'm yours. I'm so glad you're in my day. Just embarrassing, really. Just dreadfully embarrassing. How did a person like me, you know, have an education, a British education? I've ended up here. Gosh, horrible. And then I had a realization. I realized that this program, Al-Anon, was for a bunch of people who didn't know how to get restraining orders. Concerned, why don't you change locks? Why don't you move to another city, leave the kids with your mother, find another guy, move to another country, get another job? Lie on the resume, it's always good because you learn fast and you learn quick and you get going. So then I left. I was quite satisfied with my spiritual awakening, as I called it, my perception. And the problem is with my perception, it's this very thin laser line between my disease and a moment of clarity. And I need the steps and I need a sponsor for me to find out which side of the line it really is. Because on some days, it's flipping genius. I remember having this obsession with gonna get a tattoo. And I was gonna get the three-arm tattoo because that's spiritual. And I found out that the lower back is supposed to be the most spiritual place in your body. And I was like, you know what, I'm gonna get this tattoo on the most spiritual place in my body. And I was obsessed with it. And it happened to come up in some inventory, you know. I just happened, whoopsie, to read it to my sponsor. And she said, oh, when you get it done, let me know if it fixes you. Was lifted, and I had sponsees saying, well, I wouldn't get a tattoo at your age because then the ink is just going to look really wrinkly when you get old. I mean, if you're young, you know, and you're out there, that's one thing, but if you're older and, you know, you're clear minded, it's a bit stupid, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm the sponsor, shut up, bro, I'm gonna get a tattoo on my finger. I was just at the effect of it. So I left this Al-Anon and then I carried on my life, and I really believed if I could get money, property and prestige, then the world would see me, then I would be fine. And I'm going to relate to those of you who do know the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the chapter more about alcoholism. They have a whole section for the alcoholic. I think it's page 31. No, taking a trip, not taking a trip. You know, all the things that the alcoholic do, and you take away that stuff, and I'm dealing with, you know, alcoholism, as I call it, dry drunkenness. I'm doing everything I can. You know, you switch from scotch to brandy, and I switch from Scott to Randy, and he didn't fix me. I tried the different colors of the rainbow. That didn't work. Different religions of men, that didn't work. I switched from Visa to MasterCard, that didn't work. You know, I went into workaholism, I used to work retail, and then I got just sick and tired of you people. So then I went into office work, and then I got sick and tired of that, and I got carpal tunnel and a repetitive stress injury, so I can't do that neither. And it's like, oh God, give me a break. There is no freedom from this, because it's all in my mind. And what happened was I did get hurt on the job, and I said a little prayer, and I said, oh God, get me out of here. And I really believed I was going to find a much better looking man. I was going to get a better car, house, maybe I'll be on a television show. And all those boys that rejected me in high school, their children will have mad crushes on me, and there will be posters of me all around their house. Then I will feel appreciated and heard and seen. See, my inventory will never give me a break because that's what it is, and it will look for it in any person, place, or thing. And I said this prayer, and within a month I was out of that job. I was injured with severe disability. I couldn't work. Everything around me fell apart. The finances fell apart. The relationship fell apart. My health fell apart. My dreams fell apart. Basically, what I was left with was, what are you? Because either I'm going to kill myself or I have to find some reason for being here, some kind of higher purpose. And that was what basically happened. It took me to get to that point before I could come and actually surrender into the 12-step rooms. Because nothing else was working. I had tried and sat in front of psychiatrists. I had done the ring dance around them. You know, the anti-anxiety medication, I would have a million questions about how to take it, when to take it, should I take it this way, should I take it this way, which glass, but I mean, it doesn't matter. Because I will find about anything when I'm off. You know, take this pill with food. Well, are you talking like a chocolate biscuit or are you talking like a meal? Like, which one? Well, what if I have a whole load of chocolate biscuits? Is that a meal? I don't, what about a meal replacement bar? Is that still a meal? The speed at which I'm talking to you is about a tenth of the speed of my head, okay? Just so you know. So everything fell apart. Basically, I had to face that everything I had put my life on had been based on sand and not rock. And something in me said, I gotta go back to those 12-step rooms. And so I went back. Because God had to work somehow. And I will tell you, the lady who shared about having four sponsors, I had six in my first year. I had more than one sponsor at one time. Because what if you weren't available for me? Because I'm not seen and I'm not heard. So I had a magnificent plan of action. Magnificent. See, I'm not seen, I'm not heard, therefore I've got to tell you twice as much and explain myself even more, and I've got to be like, okay, I need to talk to you. Everything's dramatic. Sit down. Try to make that person really hear me. Okay, really hear me. Because I'm not heard. Rather than just asking a flipping question and they can give me an answer. I would make a whole big deal because I'm running on the inventory in my head that I don't even know that I'm running on. And it wasn't until I actually started doing the steps and had a sponsor who, finally I had a sponsor who just said, you gotta surrender this all. One, do you admit that you're powerless over alcoholism and that your mind is unmanageable, not anything in this dimensional world? Two, do you believe a power greater than you can take you to a place of sanity? And I was like, well, yeah, I have to at this point. Three, are you willing to make a decision to turn your mind over to that power? All right, I don't know. Okay, just for this moment, she said. Okay, great, let's get pen and paper and let's get cracking. I'm like, what? Well, you know, let's get writing your four step. But I was like, hold on. Don't we need to talk American twaddle for about 3 or 4 months and get to know each other before we do this? You know? And she was like, is this life or death for you? We're gonna do it now. Okay. You know? And she basically took me through the steps and she basically explained to me, a resentment basically comes from an obsession that's continuing. An obsession comes from fear. And basically, I run from my self-centered fear. The fact that I have the resentment is my part. What happened to me is just an event that occurred. The fact that I'm holding it and I'm harboring is my part, and that's what I can do. That I am responsible for the whole resentment. Now, there are things that I would go over and say I was responsible for their part, but then I would be shown that that's my way of becoming a victim, so I can't get out of what I'm doing. I was like, whoa! You know, I'll also explain very clearly that beating myself up is a way that my self-will and my disease will manage to get me in my disease and continue it, and that's part of my self-centeredness. And so I have a sponsor who's like, no, but you're not stupid, you're really great at this. I don't understand sponsors who basically yell at their sponsees and tell them they're not doing what they're doing. You know, I have a sponsor who I surrender everything, every other addiction that I have going on, everything that I'm obsessed about. I surrender it all, because I have to practice these principles in all my affairs. Now, I had tried before I had got to this to do meditation. I don't even have time to go into what I tried to do, but I went to 4 years of an artsy-fartsy school, and I knew how to sit on a yoga block and breathe out my anus. Okay. This was not creating some kind of spiritual awakeness for me. Okay? Eventually, I found a methodology of meditation that they sat you down and it heals the central nervous system. And Lord knows my nervous system needs a bit of healing. And I used to sleep for 3 hours every day because I was so fatigued. I was so worn out when I got here. And the second 20 minutes, I did this meditation and I thought, oh, and it was painful. I want to tell you it was painful. And I lay down and I didn't need that 3 hour nap. And it took my sponsor to tell me, you've just had a spiritual experience. Because you spent 20 minutes with a power greater than yourself, and suddenly you do not have to sleep for 3 hours. And the 11th step promise was right there. I will not tire so easily, because I'm not running around trying to make things fit my world. I went back to doctors, they didn't understand why I was getting well. My amends with my father was so profound that Basically, it had altered my female cycle, and I went back to a doctor and they got me off medication and they didn't know why. The only thing was different was that this amends had happened with my father. You know, the program has been instrumental in my recent dealings with my mother. She's going through cancer and there's no cure for it. And the program has been the place where I can put my fears down, because my shame comes up that I'm not good enough, that I didn't achieve A, B, C, D before she passes on. My ego gets in the way of being able to be there for her. When I go there, and today I will tell you before I wrap it up, I had what most people, most normies, would probably call a very disturbing conversation. And basically, I was on the phone with my mother, and we were organizing her popping off party, because she wants to have a party before she dies. And she wants everybody to give her a hug and a kiss before she dies, not at her funeral. And we're going to order all the food she's not allowed to eat for her cancer. We're going to have British beef. And she's going to have cava. She's not going to have cava, she's going to have real champagne. And we're organizing this, and I said, Mom, when do you want it? She goes, I have a feeling it'll be 2 years. I said, oh, go on, give me three. I go, come on, Mom, I might get married, have a baby. She, oh, no, two, Paula, two. And I'm trying to negotiate with my mom what her higher spirit is telling her. And we are laughing on the phone. June 2010, we're going to have a popping off party, you know? And of course, I put the phone down and bawled my eyes out, because I'm not ready to let go of my mom, because she's my mom. But I have my own God, and I know that she has a God that loves her more than I could even imagine, because I love my mom like this mom much. She loves me tenfold that as a parent, and I had an awakening that God loves her a million times the tenfold that she loves me. I can't even imagine the love that her higher power has for her. When it says it's time for her to go home, it's out of love. And I sort my stuff out with my inventory, my needing to fix things, so I can actually be there in the present moment for her. And that's where God is for me in the moment. That's where I experience joy that I didn't experience before until I came into these rooms and really buckled down and got into the work and the principles. I have a sponsor who underlines principles before personalities, and I sometimes tell her, I don't want your opinion, just tell me where I'm off with my ism right here so I can get back on track. And I'd like to thank you for having me come out today very much.